I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We gonna go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
You're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast, the official UK podcast for the Seattle Seahawks. Here are your hosts, Ross Bell, Stuart Court, and Adam Nathan. Go Hawks!
Welcome to the Pedestrian Podcast, still the only unofficial UK Seahawks podcast. As ever, myself, Stuart Court, is joined by Mr. Ross Bell and Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, guys?
Good, mate, good.
Adam?
Not too bad, although I've done that thing that is one of the biggest ailments for all men, and that I tried to eat some food too quickly, and I've literally hoofed the entire roof of my mouth off. So that's not a pleasurable experience. I think it's going to do me in for a couple of days, but what can you do?
This week we are convening for a very special edition of the podcast. This week we are joined by a very special and very cool guest. Before that, though, just one last plug for the upcoming 2017 National Meet. It is now just a little over 2 weeks away. It's the 27th of May in Nottingham at the Canal House Bar in the centre of the city. If you're still yet to confirm your attendance, then all you need to do is send £5 to the PayPal listed on the Facebook page and chat to website. It should be a fun night. Myself and Ross will be there. But now, for our special guest, we are joined by the former Wisconsin Badger and 2011 Seattle Seahawks draft pick, John Moffitt. How are we, John?
I'm doing great, guys. Thank you for having me.
No worries. Massive thank you for taking your time out to join us on the pod. As I said, you were a draft pick of the Seahawks 6 years ago. You were the 75th pick before the Russell Wilson pick, weren't you?
Yeah, and he actually came out of Wisconsin, too, so we were both number 75 in the third round. I was just a year ahead of him.
Yeah.
So, if you had to evaluate overall NFL success, would you give yourself the edge on 75s there?
I would say, yeah, but only because I'm just so for myself, obviously, yeah.
100%. I'm with you. He's still got a lot to prove. I think you proved it to all of us, I reckon.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. Well, I'll tell you what, though. I feel like the 75 the next year was just a little better, and it had a little better career. So,
so how was that process, the whole draft thing? Obviously, it's a few weeks out from the 2017 draft, so from your final game at Madison up to the draft weekend, how was that for you?
Yeah, it was, you know, the whole experience of pretty much when you go into your senior year of college and then all the way through to the end of your rookie year in the NFL is really, I think, the craziest time in a football player's career. Because, you know, you go through, you do the season, and then once the season ends, as soon as it ends, you train. So I actually went down to Florida and I was training all the way up until the combine, and then after you keep training because then you get drafted. And yeah, it was a wild experience. I remember it was just very fast. Like, it was just every day was just, you know, a lot of stuff, and it moves fast. It felt like it was the blink of an eye, you know.
Yeah.
So I always feel that if you were to draft, well, listening to the way that the few months between the end of the season and the draft pan out, I always think that if they ask scouts to draft the day after the college season ended and then the day after the combine, it's a completely different thing. Does it feel as much of a sort of a meat market as it seems from the outside? Because it almost seems like, you know, we saw players like Kevin King who were picked to go in the third round at the end of the season that ended up being maybe going in the first round because of the combine. It seems that the play is almost outweighed by the measurables. And does that seem right? And is that how it feels in the process?
Yeah, I totally agree, Adam. I think it was, I remember when I went into the combine, and it's interesting the way the combine is set up, because the first day you go in and you do some interviews and stuff like that. And then the second day they measure you and they do medical stuff. And I think you may do the bench press too. And then the third day you run. So you're really not set up for much success. If you think of the order of that, I spent about 5 or 6 hours in an MRI machine the day before I ran my 40. So I think they make it dance of coaches just sitting there looking at you, and you're in nothing but your skivvies, and it literally meat market is what came to mind. And I think if a guy can perform well there and they see his athleticism, like right face to face, coaches have their own ego where they say, well, I can make something out of that kid. So as far as your deduction, I think you're spot on. I think the combine I mean, yeah, day after the college versus the combine, totally different pictures.
Yeah, so obviously this year the team drafted Ethan Posick out of LSU, and John Snyder said that they didn't visit him or show really much interest in him throughout the process. Did they show much interest in you at the combine and pro days and stuff? Or
no, and that's something I think that teams like to do every now and then. Like, so for me, I went to school. I went to Wisconsin, and the John Schneider, the GM of the Seahawks, was a Wisconsin guy from Green Bay, right? He was up with Green Bay for a while.
Yeah.
So he really knew from the people that he knew in Madison. They felt like they had a good feel for me. They never interviewed me during the process. I got a call a week before the draft from John, and he was like, "Do you have any problems coming out to Seattle if we pick you up?" I said no, and then next thing you know, I got picked up by Seattle.
Yeah. So was it a nervous wait for that phone call? Obviously, the third round, was it second day?
It was, yeah, second day. It wasn't too nervous. You know, I had what I was being told and what happened was pretty close, so I had the realistic, like, I'll probably go in the third round. I went in the third round, and it was a pretty nice experience. I kept it real small, too. Some guys do parties. And that could be really stressful. I was at my grandparents' house with my parents and one best friend, and so it was no stress. It was a really enjoyable experience.
What was the best question? And when I say best, I mean it in the loosest term possible, that you got in one of those meetings with the coaches. You always hear stupid stories, like someone being asked, "What's the best way you'd kill someone?" or something stupid like that. Did you get any brilliant ones like that?
Yeah, well, I was so wild in college. Like, I had a real reputation for being a partier. So the same.
I don't know where that would have come from.
Right? Yeah. So, I mean, they're not wrong. They do their homework. So, Jeff Ireland, the same guy that asked, Dez Bryant if his mother was a prostitute. and yeah, I had a meeting with them, with the Dolphins. That was when he was with the Dolphins, and he grilled me. And he basically was like, he nailed me. He was like, not nailed me, but tried to nail me down. Like, you know, we hear this about, like, you like to go out. We see that your weight fluctuates like 20 to 30 pounds during the off season and on season. And basically we're wondering if you're just the guy that likes to party here and burn it at both ends. And I was like, oh my God. Like, it's a hard question, you know, that when they really nail you and you have the whole group of people around you, all the, you know, some front office people, coaches, some scouts. And, you know, you're just center stage and answering. And I remember being like, you know, I like to have my fun and everything, but I really do take this sport seriously. And you can just look at my film to see that. And if you really have respect, but you're yourself, I think it's fine. But, yeah, there's a lot of no-hold-barred questions, guys, with that.
Yeah, so I do some writing for a website. One of the guys I used to write with was a student at Wisconsin. He said it was like the party capital of colleges. Is that accurate with your experience there?
When I went there, and I didn't do it for this reason. When I chose Wisconsin when I was a senior in high school, I just thought it was a place I could live for 5 years. I liked the program and I liked the culture. And I was like, wow, I could be here and be very comfortable. That was like important to me because I felt like if I was comfortable where I was, I'd have success, you know, on the field. So that's why I went. But when I went in, Playboy magazine had just rated it number one party school in the country. and they got that rating like a couple times because there's these two huge parties in Wisconsin that go down that like give it a big reputation. It's Halloween where like 80,000 people show up dressed up on State Street. And then it's the Mifflin block party where it's like 30,000 in the spring on a block party. So it's like, yeah, it's a big party school.
I can't imagine Russell fitting into that school particularly well. But that 2011 draft class you were a part of, it's got, well, it's probably considered one of the best in recent years. 14 Pro Bowlers in the first 16 picks. Do you kind of look out for players from your class more so than other players that are playing in the league?
Do you mean like when you're playing? Like, do you?
Yeah,
as
I mean,
far as,
like when you're watching football now, do you kind of take more notice of, say, Campbell or Miller than?
Absolutely. Yeah, the guys that I played with, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely. Because I think you feel like you have that connection, you know?
Yeah, you're all kind of the 2011 brotherhood, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. And I root for them, too. Like, I want them to do well. I think it's like, you know, it says something in the history of it, too.
Yeah.
Yes. So what was it like when the phone call came from the Seahawks? Was like that you realized that you were now a Seattle Seahawks, you were now in the NFL? What was that experience like?
It was cool. It was surreal. when I was down there, I was down at my grandparents' house. My uncle actually prank called my phone twice. So yeah, it was like people shit. And he was there too. He was just messing with me. He played college football. He played at Temple and he was a player. So he liked to give me a hard time, but I was really, by the second time I was like, all right, you need to stop. Cause no one calls you. Everyone knows you're waiting for the call.
Yeah.
You know, so no one bothers you. And then after everybody lets you know. And that was the cool thing. Like I got picked up and I was going to Seattle and Pete called and he's like, hey, let me talk to your dad. And, he talked to my dad and then the next day was the lockout, if you guys remember.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the lockout was back on. So then Pete was like, hey, we might not be able to talk until you come into camp or this lockout's over. And I was like, okay. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Obviously in that, the 2011 class for Seattle obviously included Doug Baldwin. And there's all that, the famous letter that Snyder sent him during the lockout as well. What was the transition like from Wisconsin to the NFL or Seattle in particular? Obviously you've worked so long for, all through the process and then you get drafted. Was it a tough transition for you or?
No, it wasn't a tough transition. Other than the lockout situation, which was difficult because, you know, you get drafted and you want to get out there and go to camp and, you know, do the mini camps, do that stuff and get the playbook down and be ready for the fall. We didn't get out there until August. So it was like I was training at home and just doing, you know, like trying to be ready to go. So, that was one part of it. That was a difficult aspect. But other than that, the big difference between college and NFL is like when you play football in college at it's like your hometown and everyone watches out for you and they know that you're just playing college ball. So you're just a college kid and there's a lot more innocence, I guess assigned to it and a lot more leeway in your lifestyle. Right. So then when I went to the NFL, I realized that, oh no, no, no. Like this is like a business professional thing. Like this town, like they love and support you, but they also like, it's not your hometown. And like the team is what is like their, but that's their deal. So if you're not living up to those expectations, that's the big difference. And then also people aren't as for you. They know you're getting paid. You know, that was the first thing that I felt when I felt the transition. I was like, ooh, people are a little different because you're getting paid, you know?
Is that something that transcends not only the city, but also in the locker room as well? Because ultimately, if you're a new kid in and you might be earning less money than someone, you could potentially be taking their job. And is that something that as much as there can be a close knit locker room, I imagine a lot of people are looking over their shoulders, what with the tight salary cap and, you know, worrying about rookie coming to take their job.
Yeah, I think that's less about the money. Like I never remembered, like obviously got everybody wants to get paid, but I remembered a lot of guys being like, I heard more in the locker room guys being like, yo, that guy needs to get paid, man. The organization needs to pay him. Like, so the players are very much like for the players and knowing the organization's making crazy money. They want them paid. But to your point, yeah, it's a reality. Every year they're drafting a guy that's going to replace you. They're bringing in a guy that's going to replace you because they don't want to pay you and a younger guy is cheaper, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's always the reality. But I think guys have a good, you know, that's the great thing about guys. Like we kind of have like there's an agreement, there's the code, there's the realities of what we're doing. And there's no need to be too, you know, dramatic about it. You know what I mean?
And presumably everyone was that guy once. So it's quite an easy way to empathize with the new kid coming in.
Absolutely, Adam. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So obviously a massive part of the locker room back when you first joined and you were a big popular part of it was, Mike Robinson's Mike Robb Report. Was that a fun thing to be part of? Obviously, it opened up the locker room to people so far away from Seattle like we are.
I had a blast with that. That was one of that's kind of what got me into what I'm doing now. I also have a podcast that I just started about 3 weeks ago with a couple of friends from my town, and I do some video stuff as well. I want to shoot a movie one day. So I'm working on a short film in about 6 months. But Mike Robb really opened that. I always did radio before. I love radio. But when Mike Robb started doing that, we started shooting together. It was like it was cool because it was like a creative thing that I really enjoyed. And people were really great about it, especially in Seattle. I had like a little bit of a cult following from that show. And which made me feel really at home in Seattle, you know, where I talk about where I first come out, you don't feel that way. But, by the end, I mean, I lived in Seattle. I just left Seattle about a year ago.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I mean, it's funny how there are weird things that happen in all sports that make you remember a player. I mean, like in soccer here, I'll remember maybe a player that had the most horrific open goal miss and played like three games more than someone that played for 5 years. And the room at Robberport, like, this may not be what you want to hear as an ex-player, but I feel like that's what your name is synonymous with me, as opposed to play, which I genuinely probably mean as a compliment, because it suggests more about your personality than anything else. So in a way, yeah, a roundabout compliment, I think.
I take it as a compliment. And honestly, it was like a really cool thing for me, because it did make, I love Seattle and I love the people there and the culture. And it was like, it made it more of a home. And when I would go out, people would just, it was never about the Seahawks. People, I mean, that was like a secondary thing they knew, but they would just be like, Mothman, real Robberport. And I'd be like, wow, that's really cool. That's cool.
Yeah. The was it the Tiger Woods shade in 2012 as well for the Robots?
Mike Bob said that. I didn't say that. That was me saying that. That wasn't me, but I did. We did set that up pretty nice. That was.
I'm just amazed that Russell Wilson is now more of a robot than when you were calling him a robot. That's what is alarming to me.
It's nice for me just to be right for that long about one thing. You know
what I mean? I take it. See, on this podcast and around the Seahawks fan base, Tom Cable gets a lot of blame for the struggles of the offensive line, but it's then supported by players like Marshall Lynch and coaches and John Schneider. What was it like to play for him first?
It was interesting. I mean, every offensive line coach seems to be a person, like, they're always hard, tough guys. You know what I mean? And I don't want to just classify Tom as that, because that's not all that he is. But playing for him was obviously, like, he drives you, and he's the kind of guy that makes you a better player. What's his name? My coach at Wisconsin, Bob Bostad, who went with the Titans for a while, but he's actually back at Wisconsin. He was the kind of guy, the same thing, like a very, like, tough on you. But after my college experience, I look back and I say, wow, that guy made me an All-American. You know what I mean? So I think that was the same thing with Tom, but I learned a lot from him about, and not even at the time, because I was very stubborn at the time, but looking back, I've learned a lot. I like the way that he just approaches things and does, business, you know? He taught me a lot about the game and also about life too.
With regards to criticism of, like, offensive line coaches, I imagine that position, like, we're ultimately all idiots who try and watch a game that we don't understand, to be brutally honest about it. But at least with receivers or cornerbacks or running backs, you can sort of see what's going on and you could evaluate what's going on. It must get frustrating to see offensive linemen or your play being criticized. It really is the position that we have no idea what's going on, because we don't even know what's being called, let alone what you're trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, your questions so far have been awesome, so I wouldn't slight you guys too much on your football knowledge.
Oh, no, we are idiots, John. Yeah, we are.
Offensive line is very difficult. It's very difficult for people to understand. I felt like it's very easy to see if a guy's giving up sacks. Obviously, he's had a bad game. But when you come down to, like, the real nuts and bolts of it, where you're like, well, why didn't the running game succeed? Or why didn't – you know, why did they give up these sacks? Or what happened? There's more to it. I feel like there's been, in my past, I've had games that were great games and, you know, no one will know. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter. They only know the bad ones, right? But even they don't even understand, like, why it did work or why things don't work in terms of, like, run game and stuff like that. I think it's a tough O-line is a thing that it's hard to simulate in your mind, you know? Mm-hmm. Or it's like, I think it could be hard for people to totally get, but the coverage these days is pretty damn good, and people really – I've been talking to fans for years now, and the fan is getting a real grasp on the game. I mean, people understand coverages and stuff. It's impressive, you know?
Yeah, but with Cable, would you – when you hear the support he gets from Josh Snyder, called him one of the best line coaches in the league, do you agree with that at the same time as you – possibly agree with the criticism or
no? Well, I don't know. It's tough with Tom, because I think technically and as a coach, like, yeah, I think you could say he's like the one of the best line coaches in the league. My only thing with him is I think that he, you know, some of the players he chooses to bring in, and whether it be from upper management, like higher up, like John or Pete, in the way that they draft, but they don't he's not giving himself a lot to work with all the time. Yeah. And I don't know if that's his doing or not, you know? I mean, you can't keep converting D linemen to O linemen, expecting it to work, like slotting all these guys, switching all these positions, you know, making a guard a tackle back. Like, why can't you just draft a guy that's a really good guard and make him a guard and play in the system? Why can't you just draft a guy that's a really good tackle, make him a tackle and play in the system? Do you know what I mean? Like, I understand there's fluctuation, but that to me is his hang up. I don't know.
Well, yeah, last season, our first round pick, right tackle Jermaine Ifeti, was played at right guard for the entire season just so he could test out some other guys at right tackle, and it ultimately failed.
Yeah, that was the thing when I played. Like, now it's nice for me now because, like, I feel like I had a love hate with football, and now I just have, like, I still do, but I appreciate it and I can see it more clearly. Like, when I was playing for Tom, that was one of my biggest battles with him. You know, the second year of my career after I blew my knee out, I was going in and out, and they were substituting me with J.R. Sweezy James, Carpenter. And I mean, you go back and watch those games, I outplayed them. I was going in for them when they were messing up and everything and back and forth. So we could experiment. So you get to that as a player. That's why I feel like, Marshawn Lynch will say, hey, Tom's great, but one of his players may be like, yo, that was a mess, you know? But still, I respect the guy because he works his ass off and he can make a lot of things. I think he does it to cover. It could be strategy. He does it to cover them so that guys can play a lot. They don't want to invest in an offensive line at Seattle. They like having cover. They believe in coverage. They're defensive minded. So, and if you have Russell, that's the thing about this. Like, there's always a lot of strategy and depth that goes into it. So really, when you weigh it out at the end, you got to be like, well, did they win or lose? Did they perform or not? You know?
Yeah. So obviously your second year is the year that Russell Wilson turned up, and there's a great quote I remember from Mike Robinson after the Chicago overtime win where he said, our quarterback's a bad man. Was there a moment when you realized that the Wisconsin kid who followed you was special?
I heard, so John Schneider actually asked me about him when I was a rookie at Seattle, and because he was at Wisconsin, and I had been hearing, like, a lot of my boys that were offensive linemen at Wisconsin have been telling me, like, no, he's really legit. He really is. Like, he's the whole deal. And I heard that his work ethic was just, you know, unmatched. So when Schneider told me that, I told him exactly what I had heard. Then when he came in, I think I gave him a ride somewhere. Like, really early on, we were at a charity function or something. And so he was in my car and we were just talking because I didn't get to know him there. And I remember how excited he was. He was like, how's Pete, man? Is like awesome playing for him? Like, and like, you could just feel the energy. I remember that. And I, of course, like, I'm a lineman, so everything sucks for me. So I was like, yeah, man, Pete's our damn ball. All right. It is what it is. Let's go. But his energy and his excitement, I think I kind of got to see it coming a little bit before people, you know?
Yeah.
With regard to practice and players, like in soccer, often you'll hear a player saying about a fellow professional, like in training, he'll pick the ball up, dribble past three guys and smash it in the corner every time. In the NFL, presumably, I mean, do they practice at full pace? And are you able to see in practice how good someone is, or is that more reserved for the game when that happens, if that question makes any sense?
No, it makes great sense. I think you can tell. The practice, there's times in football to go really hard. Like in camp, there'll be days where it's like, all right, we're grinding, we're earning positions, and you're killing it. During the season, you practice at a high pace and a high speed, but it's very controlled because injury prevention and all that goes into that.
Yeah.
But you can still tell, like a guy like Earl Thomas, like I used to love to chase him when he would throw an interception because I'd love to see his relative speed compared to mine, which was like off the charts. And so you knew a guy like that, like he doesn't have to, he can still make, like you can still see his speeds like just heads above everyone. You know, you can just see like in their technique, like certain guys, you can just tell they're better. And then obviously when they get on the field, they're really better, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you played with Russ at the start of his career and Peyton at the end of his career. What are kind of the major differences between the two guys, or were they more similar than we would kind of think?
They, very similar in their professionalism and, you know, how they dressed, because they both dressed like really clean cut, very like white guy dressing. So they're both, that was a similarity to like the guys that would bring a briefcase to work. I think Peyton brought a briefcase. I'm not sure. I thought I saw him in the parking lot once. And, I remember we were in the parking lot. My girlfriend dropped me off and she's like, is that Peyton? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, he's dressed like how your dad dresses. I was like, I know. He's like almost as old as my dad. And she's like, and everybody else behind him, like you see all these other dudes and we're all in hoodies and just like dressed like, you know, like kids basically. But the work ethic, the professionalism, like I think Peyton obviously, you know, the big difference with Peyton is he was older and no one questioned like his leap. Was just like, hey, Peyton says, like coaches would be like, Peyton says, you know, and that's kind of what he had gotten to. But, Russell, very professional, very, you know, does things right.
I think I was in Seattle and heard you on the radio, I think with Softy in Seattle. And I the story never forgotten that something like you saw Peyton Manning on your first day. He didn't know who you were. And on the second day, he knew your name and background and social security number and left, right, and center.
Yeah.
What other stories are there about him like that? Because he just, I'm in awe of him. I think he's just an incredible player and a guy, and he's just sort of one of those guys that you want to hear stories about, really.
Yeah, he was. I don't know. I don't want to say like hit it off, and we were like hanging out at each other's house, but I had a good rapport with him, and I remember when we were at the Halloween party. And he was wearing a Fred Flintstone mask. And I didn't realize it was him. And I was talking, I was dressed as Jesus. And I was talking to him. And then obviously I knew it was him. And he said to me, he was like, you know, this is like my favorite day of the year. Cause I get to wear the mask. And I was like, damn, Peyton. I was like, I would feel bad for you, but I know how much money you have. So I don't But great. And he said it with levity. Like he wasn't like crying in his beer or anything, you know what I mean? But you could tell he wore the damn mask the entire Halloween party.
It's amazing how players like Demaryius Thomas and other players in his roster seem to be just in love with the guy when he was retiring. Is that something that he just it breathed just like a presence at all times?
Yeah, I mean, when I showed up, I mean, he was, you know, he had been Peyton Manning for a long time, and he just, you know, I mean, he tells stories like he had all these stories because his dad played and he grew up around the Saints. And like, yeah. I mean, the guy was like a child of the NFL, like, and his family was like NFL royalty. So it was kind of, I mean, he had great. I can't remember exactly what the story that he told, but he would talk to us before, you know, like team meetings and stuff. And having that guy talk to you, he's like 20 years older than everyone, but can still ball. It was kind of it's a lot of. Everyone knows how hard it is to make it long in the NFL. When guys survive, it's like they carry a respect. And then obviously Peyton, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so to get to Denver, obviously you were traded to them by the Seahawks. Was it a bad breakup with the Seahawks, or was it just a reinforcement of the
business side of it? It was bad. It started in the spring. I went into Pete's office in the spring because I was really pissed off. I was getting like no reps in OTAs, and I had just finished the second season where I played in the playoffs. Like they were still using me as a crutch for Sweezy, using me as a crutch for Carpenter. So I went into Pete's office and I basically like had it out with him, to the point where like I was really trying to nail him to the wall and just be like, hey, you believe in competition. Why aren't you letting me compete? And that's the thing that bothered me about my career. Cause I felt like, you know, people didn't really give me enough. They didn't really see enough of what was going on, and I kind of got dogged with certain things, and I felt that way. So I had told that to Pete, and I was basically like, Pete, I think you should just trade me, because I was trying to force a trade. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't feel like they were, I knew they were just gonna like use me up this year and then probably cut me after, and I would have no it's strategy, right? I would have had no playing time or anything, and then I'd be out on the market like cheap. So, he was basically like, no, but then they did trade me in August at the worst possible time.
Yeah.
So there was that bad blood, and Pete carries bad blood, like Lofa Tatupa. He said stuff to him when he cut him about the USC thing. So like Pete does do that. And that's kind of what happened with us. So bad blood, cause they traded me to the Browns.
Yeah. But what happened with that trade? Obviously, cause it was announced and they reneged on the deal with a physical or something.
I mean, I feel like that was like a sabotage, like a total sabotage thing, because they traded me to the Browns. And when I was leaving, John was in the office with me, and he's basically like, he's the one that told me, and he was basically like, yeah, you should really be like smart about the medical examination they give you, because I just don't know how like legit. They just sounded weird about the trade. I was like, what does that shit mean? They sounded weird about the trade. Yeah, we're doing the trade. And so then, of course, I go out to Cleveland, and I do my medical run throughs. And the doctor was like a saint. The doctor afterwards, I'm meeting with him. He's like, do you want to see all your MRIs? I'm like, absolutely. So he shows me all of them. And he's like, yeah, your knee's actually, you know, you're pretty good. Like, you have a little arthritis, but that's normal for like what happened with your knee and everything. He's like, honestly, you're full. He gave me like a full. He's like, you look great. So then I go back to the Browns facility, and they call my agent. And my agent calls me, and he's like, I'm like getting gear on and getting ready and shit. And there's actually a picture of me in a Browns uniform on the practice field before we signed anything. I just was going through like, we're good, right? The Browns call my agent. Agent calls me, and he's like, they want you to take half the money that you would have this. They want you to take cut your thing in half for this year. Whatever I was going to make that year, they want it in half, right? And I was like, and I was like, well, no, that's illegal, because if it's a trade, you can't do that. It's a trade. So he goes back to them, and then that's when they're like, hey, don't, you can't do anything. Wait, you just got to wait. You can't go on the field. So then the coach called me up. I think it was Chudnovsky. Was that who it was?
And yeah, that sounds right.
Right. And so he calls me up there, and he's like, yeah, they're failing you on your physical. And so I looked at him, and I was like, fuck you. Like, honestly. I was like, I know what you're doing. And I'm like, this is not, I know, like, don't do this, bud. And he was like, he didn't even confront me. He just stood up and started walking in the office. He was like, come with me. Well, I'll bring you to the, and he brought me down to the meeting with all the front office people.
Wow.
And so I'm down there in the meeting with the front office people, and it's like the GM, I think the president might be there, and then some scouts, and the Chudnovsky just scurries out of the room and goes to get the head athletic trainer, so this guy can explain it. So I'm in there with the GM, who actually was a sharp guy, and he's like, dude, I don't know what. He's like, I'm sorry. He's like, honestly, we saw your film, and we thought, hey, we're adding a good guy to this team. Like, we're ready to go. And I was like, that's what I'm like, man. I could play here. Your shit's really simple. Like, I can do this tomorrow. Like, let's go. Cause I wanted to play. So they're just apologizing to me. They bring the trainer in, and the trainer starts to explain how I failed the medical. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes for like 2 minutes, and then I was just like, okay, stop. I was like, this fucking guy tapes ankles. Okay. The real doctor, the one that has all the cool equipment and shit, he told me I'm fine. So I know that this is a contract thing. And I go, I don't know why you guys are even doing this. And I can't believe you're doing this a contract thing. You're fucking me, because you're going to tell the whole league that I fail a medical, and you're going to potentially ruin my career. Like, fuck you guys for that. And I was so mad. I was so, so mad. And they were basically like, they couldn't say a word, because they knew that's what was happening.
Yeah.
So yeah. then I walked out of the office, and luckily John Elway called me like 10 minutes later. and he was like, hey, I wanted to, his fucking voice, John Elway. He's like, hey, I was like, we got, you know, we're going to bring you in here to get you a medical. I know they're playing bullshit. And they're like, I'm like, yeah, let's go. So then I went right to Denver, and they fucking brought their ankle taper over and had him look at me. And he was like, yeah, you're fine. I didn't even go to medical shit for them. And like, that's it. So then get this one though. So I'm at Denver now, and I go into the meeting the next day, the team meeting, because they had just played a preseason game. It was halfway through. And I'm sitting there, and the team that they just got beat by is the Seattle Seahawks. They got their ass beat. So I was just there, and it was like 40-10 they got beat. It was a preseason game. So now I'm in the other end, and I'm watching, and John Elway comes out to the front with the whole team. And he just starts tearing everybody's asses. Like, he's like, I don't get beat 40-10. He's like, I don't give a shit if we have Peyton. He was like flipping out. And everyone, after we left, everyone was like silent, and they were like, that was the craziest shit ever. Cause he's the president. He's not supposed to do that. You know, it's like a very rare thing. And, that to me was like the real, like dot, like the period on the end of the Seattle thing, like to go from that and then see the other end. And then I was in Denver for the rest of the time.
That Cleveland story sounds like the dream where you also don't have any trousers on. It just doesn't right? sound like a good situation.
Right?
In terms of Cleveland, I mean, you sounded pretty much like you just wanted to play. is there a sense when you get traded that Cleveland is a graveyard and Denver or Green Bay is the pinnacle, for example? Do players care particularly or about who you might play with or against, or is it just get me playing football?
Yeah, I think it's with my situation, because I was in my third year of my contract, so it was a big year, and I was just like, I don't care where I'm at, I'm going to ball out there, and I'll get because you want to get that second contract. You know, that's what it's all about. Cleveland, like, my girlfriend was like crying. I remember when I came home from Seattle, because I was like, hey, I got traded to Cleveland today. And she's like, Cleveland, like, it's like, she's like looking at houses. You can get like 14 bedroom houses there for like nothing. It's like, she's like, no, I don't want to live there. But I was like, well, it doesn't matter. But, yeah, it was, my motive was to play anywhere. If you're a player that's like a guy that coming off of like 4 years of starting and looking for my second contract, maybe you want to go to a better team. Maybe you want to go somewhere that is a better city or something, but usually it's the money first, you know?
Mm-hmm. So in Denver, was there a massive like locker room culture or coaching difference between the Broncos and Seattle?
Yeah, they weren't as cool as Seattle. And that was what was depressing to me. Like Seattle, credit to Pete, like, this is my love hate shit. Credit to Pete, like, he does make it fun and he does keep the locker room, like, he believes in that stuff. You know what I mean? So the locker room is, you know, I don't know. And it was a young, oh yeah, Pete hates old guys. So he likes all young. It's a locker room full of young guys, like having, like in the same parts of their life doing the same kind of stuff. Whereas like Denver was like older and corporate, like everyone was like an older guy with a family, and that's like totally different.
Yeah, what about with the coaching? Obviously, from Tom Cable to Denver, was it the same system in Denver or different teachings? Or
it was it was such a different system. They and not really one that was geared towards like my style of play. You know, Denver, like heavy pass. They passed the ball like 40, 50 times a game, and I was like considered coming out of college like a really good run blocker. You know,
yeah.
So it wasn't the best fit, and it was a lot different than the technique that Tom taught. I honestly thought Tom's system's way better, but it was a lot different. So it took me some adjusting time. I love John Fox, the head coach. He was great. And my coach was Steve Magazu. I don't know where he's at now, but he was a good guy too.
Yeah.
Just on a very basic level, what's the difference in how you actually stand up and press between run and pass blocking?
Oh, what do you mean? Like how I like
what as in is what is run blocking pushing forward and pass blocking sort of settling back?
Yeah, exactly. Because the run obviously like you know they're gonna hand it off and then we're trying to go forward. It's a ground attack, but the passing you want to drop back and create a pocket for the quarterback. So it's more like I'm a good athlete, but I'm not like a great pass protector athlete. I was a better run blocking kind of guy. Do you know what I mean? Like I use size and power and explosiveness, and that was kind of like my forte, if you will.
Yeah. So a couple of months later in Denver, you retired. Was that something that was a long time coming, or was it just like a eureka moment for you?
No, it was a long time coming because like I said, when I went into Pete's office in the spring, you know, I was already like very. You know, during my second year that season, I was very, I was not happy with how things were shaking out with my play. And I felt like, you know, it's somewhat like, I don't know. I thought I was better and I didn't think I was getting a fair shake. And I was kind of becoming disenchanted with like the NFL and like some of the usury that goes on in it. And like how, like the business side of it, like the darker side of it that I was just like, man. So by the time I got to Denver, I was totally like done, and I didn't, you know, after the Browns, after what happened with Cleveland and that dishonesty, and then after with like Seattle, like where they decided to trade me and when, and like all those things, I really got sick of the game, not the game, well, kind of the game, but the manipulation too. It was interesting when I left in Denver. I had personal issues, and then I also had issues with the game and where I was. So. A lot of people always ask me, because I just left, it was so abrupt, and I tried to explain myself at the time, but I don't think I could have fully even understood it myself. It was just like an emergency, like I had to rip the emergency cord, you know?
Yeah.
And, but like when I look back at now, you realize that like, it was a big culmination of things. It wasn't just one thing. It was my worries about my physical health in the game, and then it was my just disdain for the NFL, and then just like how much I was getting sick of kind of the everyday beating stuff. Like it just got to the point where, and then personal issues. I had addiction issues. So like my life wasn't, it was wildness all over. So I think I really just needed to find balance. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That makes sense. So you talk about the dark side of the NFL. So Richard Sherman, someone who's quite vocal in how it's they contradict themselves every turn. So when you hear players like Richard with the perch that he has, being one of the top players at his position in the league, do you sit there and agree and wish that there'd have been conversations they had when you were in the league, kind of thing? Or
yeah, and I tried to have those conversations right when I left. I mean, honestly, I feel like I was like the first person that was like who had just left and was talking about it. And especially with, you know, Jay Billings, maybe I did a podcast with him and I talked about the dirty side of the game and the dirty business of it. And then I was also very concerned about the concussion issue and how much they had just not opened up about that. And it always really bothered me how, you know, like players are held to this moral standard and always pointed at in the media and held up to be looked at, but like never look at the owners, never look at the business, never look at, you know, who's really running things. Like to look at a player and worry about what he's doing is like such a like small part of the NFL creature. It's like a distraction to me. It distracts from what's really going on, you know?
Yeah. So did, when you walked away, did you have any regrets, or was it just a book close, move on for the next, and just putting yourself first kind of thing?
No, I did. You know, I have a love-hate relationship with football. Like, that's the best way I can describe it. Like, it's a part of me, but it's also not, and it's something that I don't want to be a part of me. And then it's something that I love and respect, and I think that, like when you guys talk football and we talk about those aspects of the game, like that's the beautiful part of it. You know what I mean? That's the thing that I'm like, and that's so cool. And that's like, it's strategic and there's so much that goes into it, moving parts that are so fascinating. But then when you experience the other side, I think you're like, oh my God, you get worn out on it, you know? And the NFL, unfortunately, is more than just a game. It's one of the biggest businesses in the world, you know?
Yeah. How did the deal with the time in Philadelphia come about? Was that something you pushed for, or?
Yeah, I did, because I wanted to make, I did, I almost, it's so weird, I almost did it like to not have a regret just in case. Do you know if that makes sense? Like, I left abruptly, and then it had been a year and a half, and I had went to rehab, and I had gotten clean, and I was like, you know what, maybe you weren't thinking right. Maybe if you gave it another chance and you saw it, and maybe it would feel different. You know, maybe it wouldn't feel like it did. Some of that was your issues. So I did, and I went back and trained, and I actually got cut. I was there for a month. It was just too much time. I just wasn't – it had been too much time off. You know what I mean? I just wasn't on the level anymore. But I was honestly thankful, because the training process and going back and then kind of like feeling like – you know, it's like an old girlfriend. You're like, I'd like to end it nicely. Like that's kind of how I feel with the NFL. Like I think we ended like, you know, we separated on better terms, and I was fine with that, you know?
Yeah.
You're seeing more and more players have the concussion issue. A, is it something that people even talk about in the locker room? And B, is it something that you think is going to hinder the sport in the future? I mean, not that I'm probably going to have much of a chance being based in London, but I would never let my kids play. It's the one sport I would just not let them play. I mean, I'd be fine with them playing rugby. If I ever had kids, I have to stress this at this point. But I just wouldn't let them play it for the head injury issue. I can't see how it's not going to become more and more prevalent.
That's the thing. I mean, we're the best propaganda country in the world. So with our media, like that it might actually help with the NFL, because they might last. But I feel like no one talks about it in the locker room, because it's just so, you know,
it's not like, alpha.
Yeah. But after, I mean, that's the thing, like, with my decision, with my love-hate aspect of it, like, I did get out at 27 years old, and now, like, I feel like when I'm 40 or 50, I'll be in much better shape than if I got out at 35. And that's the reality. But no one wants to hear the story of, like, the ex-player, you know, because it's not entertaining. But there's a lot of ex-players that are suffering, like, every day. And that's something I think parents are taking account of. And so now the NFL will start to turn into a thing that's like, you know, almost like for like people who don't have the means, a better means to get out. Do you know what I mean? That's how I feel about it. Like, or it could become if the information was more available. My issue is that they're holding back brain research just by being the NFL. You know, because them not directing their funds into brain research is the same as like them trying to stifle it. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's such a large entity, like scientists will know. So there's, you have to think like, people think like, oh, they do this, or yeah, they give a little and they help under their control, but you know, scientists are reaching out like, hey, we'll do this. Hey, we'll do this. And they're not funding it, you know? So
that was an interesting point about like getting out of something. You have people using it for that, as a sort of a roundabout way. This draft obviously saw Joe Mixon getting drafted by the Cincinnati Bengals after obviously the much vaunted and much talked about video of him hitting the woman, unfortunately. Yeah. Does it bug you? Is probably the wrong term. Does it rankle that a guy like that ends up with the exact same equal opportunities, and the only sort of faux piousness going on is people saying, well, I wouldn't draft him in the first round, but as a fourth rounder, yeah, that would be fine.
I don't know, because I had a domestic situation myself where I felt, you know, I was innocent in it, but what was painted for me was not the right picture at all, and made me look bad, like very bad. I was in an abusive relationship, you know, I was abused, and men can't talk about that. But it's ironic to me that the poster boy for abusive relationships would be the NFL and the things that they perpetuate. Do I have it's again back to like the moral judgment, like how much of what you do morally affects your ability to earn money in the real world, and is that a fair balance? Because like a regular guy who's going to his job every day and has a domestic situation, the thing with domestic situations, and I'm not standing up for it, he clearly hit her, like there's no, you know what I mean, I'm not condoning that at all, you know what I mean, but at the same time, when you have, and we're taught this in the NFL, if you have a domestic situation and the cops come to your house, you're getting arrested unless you're on the floor passed out bleeding. So think of the position that puts you in as a player. And then when you're with someone and they understand that. So any argument, any call, they come over, you're arrested. Now that's in the news. Domestic violence, this happened. And it's basically, it's character assassination, because it's the police reporter. It's that side. So it's whatever is said about it is what's said about it.
Sure.
And I think that it's, even the statistics of domestic violence, people don't understand. Most times it's when it goes from men to women, it's in defense of themselves. And people, no one talks about how much men are abused in domestic violence and how much they're in abusive relationships as well. It's always just the man. And that's a societal commentary. That's a commentary on society, because masculinity, people are at war with masculinity right now. People are attacking the masculine. They're trying to make masculine energy look like it's dangerous or it's violent or it's not safe. And it's always after that, especially in the media right now. That's what a liberal media does, just to make that totally clear. But I have to be totally, you know, with my experience with it, you know?
Overall, do you think Roger Goodell is doing a good job as the big boss in charge?
No. No, he's absolutely awful. Roger Goodell is, aside from the fact that, you know, it's borderline criminal what he did with they've known about the concussion thing for years. And then he's going to do and act like that. No, I think Roger Goodell's terrible, and I have no problem saying that. And the fact that he gets paid what he does is criminal too.
Yeah, that paycheck is ridiculous.
Yeah, but he's about image control, and he's about quality control. He's about, people need, because they brought the female aspect into the NFL, because they go after women as an audience now, they have to soften it. Like, it's all about them with their brand. So the players fall in line with that same thing, even though we're doing just like the most violent shit ever on the field.
Yeah.
Like, somehow that has to cross over to you being like a church boy as well. And then like having this moral code that's made up. Like, Roger Goodell's never done anything that's consistent. It's just reactionary and made up and harsh, you know?
Yeah.
So just quickly back on the domestic issues and stuff. Obviously, Frank Clark has been making some headlines the last couple of days after his tweet to the female journalist in regards to something she wrote about him,
yeah,
and his arrest. Just two things. Is it tempting when someone, as you said, people wrote things about you when you didn't really give your side of the story? Is it tempting to go after, in a different way, to a lesser extent, as Clark did? But is there a temptation there to just shout your side of the story over the noise?
Yeah, but you're at such a disadvantage because, you know, you can't beat, you know, when my things happened, I never said anything. You know, when I got arrested in Chicago, I didn't say anything because I'm not going to be given that kind of coverage for that anyways. And then whatever I say will be used against me, and like, it'll never turn out good. The best thing to do is just keep your mouth shut. And maybe one day down the road, like right now, someone will ask you something and you'll have an opportunity to like reveal, you know, share something of yourself, you know?
Yeah.
I understand his, you know, I don't really understand it because he did hit her. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I guess that's my problem. Like, I didn't do that. I was threatened. I was driving down a highway 80 miles an hour and she grabs at the steering wheel and tries to steer it off the road. Sure. But that's not talked about in the police report. It's just her size, you know? Like, yeah. You know, no one gives a shit. And now I have to go through how long being like, oh, he's abusive. And it's like, damn. That's because my problem with the whole plea, like, you know, they don't have the other side. With him, he shouldn't have said anything to that woman. He should have just, you gotta just take the heat. It's very hard and it hurts a lot, I think. But that's part of the deal, unfortunately.
Yeah. At the same time, how, obviously you've spent time in the locker room in Seattle. How would that be dealt with by his teammates? Will there be something like an arm around the shoulder type deal or?
No, I mean, that's the thing. It's only the perception of the fans and everyone else is that everyone would think that way. But like your teammates are actually going to talk to you and like know the story and know you. And also every guy in that locker room has the same concern when it comes to women. I mean, women are the most dangerous thing for an NFL player. There's nothing more dangerous than a woman for an NFL player. She could take everything from you easily. It's true. And you see it with a lot of players. And even down to the simplest thing as if you two get into a verbal argument and she calls the cops and the cops come, you get arrested and that's in the news.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, think of that. That's by the balls. Never mind if you even marry one of these women. And then, you're, you know, half of your money is gone.
Obviously you had like Gayron Conley as well, have his illegal issues days, hours before the draft, and it possibly cost him a couple of million dollars. And it all seems to be somewhat of a fairy tale from all concerned. Adam?
Yeah, I was going to say, just to change a bit slightly, Stu and I have been fortunate enough that we've been to Seattle for, I think, the last 4 or 5 years to watch a game. What are your favorite Seattle spots when you were living there?
Oh, my God. That town, I mean, the whole town. I loved the sushi. Did you guys happen to get sushi out there?
Yeah, a little bit. My aunt lives there, so I sort of get shown around. And, there was some great sushi in Bellevue and Capitol Hill area we had.
Yeah, I loved it. So I used to go to this place, Umisaki House, and then there was another one this Microsoft guy up in Seattle owned. I forget what it was called. Nishino. Nishino is the best sushi in Seattle. Amazing. And then, I love the bar scene. I love the whole every part in Seattle, it all felt a little different. It had like a whole different vibe, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that was my favorite place to drink. Shoot. I don't know. It's been so long. There was a dive bar called Dino's right down the road from the practice facility. That was great. It was like right off the 7. So yeah, I love the culture there. I'm actually going to go back and visit pretty soon here because it's been a little while.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think me and Adam last year were lucky enough to be given a tour of the facility in Renton, and we all convened before the tour in Dino's as well. Dive bar is definitely the correct description for that place.
Oh, I used to love that spot. Something about it, it's like homey. I used to love a nice homey dive bar, you know?
Brilliant.
So, what have you been doing since you retired? Obviously, you've got the Down by Law podcast. Is anything else you've been doing with your time since you?
Yeah, I got the Down by Law podcast. We're on iTunes and SoundCloud, and I just started shooting. I want to make a movie. This is like my long term. This is my big goal, but I got to make a short film first. So I'm making, I'm shooting a 20-minute movie in like August or maybe September. And, then I want to enter it into some of the film festivals and kind of keep going from there. I have a real passion for cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah. Cool. So, when we told people we were having you on, a couple of people sent in questions. One was from, World Travelers. He wants to know if you still have and still wear your kilt.
It's in my closet. It's in my closet. Still got it. We did a Men in Kilts charity, back in Seattle. And, yeah, they gave me the kilt. It's a real kilt. It's beautiful. Yeah, so, I still do. No, and you're nothing under, like the rules.
Nothing if not authentic.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So how did the podcast come about? You said it was with friends from your hometown, and for those who may have missed it in its early episode, what is it about? And
yeah, it's, you know, I love radio. I always have. I got into it when I was in college, and so it was kind of something I wanted. You know, I really dragged my ass for a couple of years after football. Like, it was a whole process of like finding myself and getting healthy and like the whole thing. And so I really started to find the things that I enjoy again. And this is one of them. The podcast is so a friend of mine, you know, we hang out BS every now and then. And we were like, you know, we should do talk. He loves talk radio. I was like, we should do a podcast, and that's kind of how it started. And we're just having fun with it, you know.
Yeah, I've listened to a couple episodes. Obviously, I listened to one where you had UConn's, is it Matt Walsh was on one of the episodes.
Yep.
Talking about
yep.
his draft experience. Has he been picked up by a team?
Yeah. Oh, he didn't get picked up, man. I was I was not disappointed, but I was just upset for him. You know, it's. You know how many people try, it's every year. It's like there's always guys that don't make it. He didn't make it, but I think he's going to go play up in Canada.
Yeah.
And, I think he's going to try again with the NFL, but the show's basically a theme based, you know, each week we pick a new theme, and it's, Down by Law, Escape the Prison of Your Mind. So it's just trying to look at things from a different perspective. And, we usually go for counterculture and, more taboo, and just try to explore it with an openness, you know?
Yeah. Obviously, with Matt, is that something you'd be open to in the future? You being like some sort of like an advisor person to draftees, or that's something you've done in the past as well?
No, you know, Matt is like, he lives like a town away from me. He's known my family for a while. Like, my family's known his, and I just wanted to help him during the time, just to, you know, whatever advantage I could give him. But there is something really gratifying about, kind of that giving back, and football, it's hard to do unless that's specific. So it was like a really nice thing for me, you know?
Yeah.
With regards to, us over on this side of the pond, firstly, who have you ever, been over this side? And secondly, is there any sense, you know, amongst the, I know obviously that there's games in London now, but is there a realization of quite how big the sport is becoming here? Cause it really is. It's really growing at an incredible rate.
That's fantastic. I've heard that people are really starting to enjoy it, and it's really starting to grow. I didn't know it was that, like, it's really blowing up. And I haven't been, and I want to so bad. I have not made it over. But I'm dying to. I've always wanted to see London.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure I can speak for everyone over here. There's an open invite to you anytime you can head over.
Well, if I get out there, we'll have to sit down in person and do the cast, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Stuart and I are going to be in New York for the Giants game in October. So if you're anywhere around that area, that would be great.
Oh, I'm an hour and a half away. I'd love to come out.
Cool. So yeah, just like massive thanks to you, John, for obviously taking an hour or so out of your day and joining us, and just like preaching to the choir kind of thing on the set and a few different things. Where can people get in touch with you and follow you and keep up to your post NFL life on social media?
Yeah, I'm Moffitt74, M-O-F-F-I-T-T 74 on Twitter. And then my podcast is downbylawpodcast.com, but we're on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, as I said, I can speak for Adam and Ross as well. Massive, massive thanks for joining us. This has been the Pedestrian Podcast. Until next time.
Go Hawks.
That is going to do it. 12, they're bringing the trophy home. Your Seahawks, Super Bowl 48 champions.